The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Have you ever heard of turning a blind eye? You know, what it means is to avoid seeing certain facts that you don't want to see. But this term comes from a 19th century British naval battle that took place. And it was in 1801 that the British fleet were fighting Denmark and Norway's combined navies. Three of the British ships ran aground. And Admiral Hyde Parker decided, you know, it's just too risky to continue the battle. Let's get out of here. Stop the fight now. And so the Admiral sent a message through his flagman to Horatio Nelson. The message said, discontinue our action and withdraw. Well, Nelson heard his own signalman relay the message, but he pretended not to hear him, and he was just mesmerized. This man loved war, and he was mesmerized by the fighting and the battle going on. And he had no intention of obeying this order. Just then, a Danish cannonball hit his mast, and it came tumbling down, splintering everywhere, even falling on top of him as it was. And at this, Nelson said this, this day may be the last for us at any moment. But typical of Nelson's stubbornness and aggressive approach to war, he already had lost sight in one of his eyes in a previous battle. And he was pressed to respond to Parker's order. And Nelson told his flag captain, you know, I only have one eye, so I have the right to be blind sometimes. And then Nelson held his telescope up to his good eye and he said, I really don't see the signal. And he looked at the signal with his blind eye in order to achieve his desired result. So sometimes I say that we're a little bit like Nelson. You know, we know to do something right, and yet we cover ourselves, our eye. We don't see it. We turn, as it were, a blind eye. That's where that term came from this battle. And we willingly ignore the truth. So let's go to Luke 10, if you will. When government uses executive privilege and not Congress to gain their way, when they drop off thousands of illegal immigrants around, what are they doing? They're turning a blind eye to the Constitution. They turn a blind eye to the law of the land. They are turning a blind eye to the needs of all these people that are being dropped off. What are they going to eat? How are they going to live? You know, what's going to happen to them? They don't look at the future damage that they're causing. And so right now, America is turning a blind eye to what's going on in the Middle East. We've got Iran is building a bomb. Israel sent over a representative to ask us for support to bomb Iran, and we turned a blind eye to that situation. We're not going to help you, you know. The IRS targeted specific political groups, and we turned a blind eye. We printed money and borrowed it from the Federal Reserve. Now we have to pay it back with interest. And we turned a blind eye to the inflation it was going to cause across the nation and how millions of people were going to be hurt because of what they were doing. So the government's collecting data on every single one, and it's strictly against the law to do this without a warrant. And if they find that somebody disagrees with them, they can go right to their database and find something somewhere on them that they can use to coerce them to stop what they're doing. You know, there's no way that the CEO of the Veterans Hospital didn't see what was happening. He had to walk through the doors to get to his office, and he saw the people lined up. He saw the people not getting care. There's no way. But what happened was he turned a blind eye to their suffering because bonuses meant more to him than the veterans who had been hurt to allow him to live. And people do this all the time. They turn a blind eye, you know. We are, you know, as a people, in our society permeated with these values and these standards of our culture and society. And so politicians make promises that they never intend to fulfill. They just don't do it. In business, people say, you know, our products are the best, you should buy our product, but it's from China, you know, and it lasts a year at the most, and then that's it. Gets through the warranty, and that's about it. But my point is, can you see how easy it is to live in a society that is doing this and to not be affected by it somehow, to not think that you can do it too in your own way? We tend to see what we want to see. We tend to hear what it is we want to hear. And that's the way human nature is. And in this way, it's so much easier to justify our actions, isn't it? So I think it's something I want to talk about today. Let's go to Luke 10. You know, in one particular point, Christ told a story that reflects this tendency, I think, and in verse 25 through 29. Behold, a certain lawyer stood up, and he tempted him, saying, Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said unto him, What's written in the law? How do you read it? And answering, said, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said unto him, You have answered right. Do this, and you shall live. But he, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, Who is my neighbor? You understand where he's coming from? He wants to blind his eye to who it is. He wants to narrow the field down to a select few. He wants to justify himself. He wants to appear like he's blameless. He wants people to think that he kept the law. But the Jewish people had a saying, and he believed in the saying, and that is this. If you can justify yourself on earth, you can justify yourself in heaven. That was what they believed. And so he was right in the process of playing that game and justifying himself. He thought Christ was like most of the other religious leaders, and they looked down on others in their heart. And this man wanted to narrow it down to, my neighbor is the guy that lives next to me. He's Jewish. You know, he's an Israelite. You know, that's who my neighbor is. And Christ explained to him in verse 30, Jesus answered and he said, A certain man went down to Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise a Levite, when he was at the place, he came and looked on him, and he went on the other side of the road. You know, why? So he wouldn't see him. And a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him. And he went to him, and he bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and he set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence, and gave them to the host, and said unto him, Take care of him. And whatsoever you spend more, when I come back, I'll repay you. And then Christ says, Which now of these three do you think was neighbor unto him that fell among thieves? The priest turned a blind eye. The Levite turned a blind eye. But the Samaritan did something to help this suffering man. He saw it and didn't avoid it and didn't pretend it didn't exist. And you got to remember, the Samaritans were hated by the Jews. And here is a Samaritan that helped haters of his people, himself. But he refused to turn a blind eye to that man's suffering. And you have to admire this point of view. Luke 14. I say this because, you know, verbal intentions, they mean next to nothing. Written intentions don't mean anything more. It's what you and I do that really counts. I still remember my mother's, what seeming like it was her favorite saying. She'd catch me for not doing what I was supposed to do. And she'd say, tell me, you know, I'd tell her, you know, Mom, I intended to do it. I planned on getting to it. I really was. And she'd say this, and it's still ringing in my ears today. Well, Butchie, she said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Intentions don't matter. You can have all the intent in the world. And if you don't do, you're failing. And it's so important to us in our calling. I never understood the depths of this saying that she said until later in life, because this happened to me where God called me. I studied the church literature, and I wanted to be baptized, and I counseled with the minister, as all of us did. And every single one of us read this very same truth that I want to read to you today. We promised that we would do the best we could to be like Jesus Christ. So look at chapter 14 and verse 27. I'm sorry, 26. If any man comes to me and hates not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Now, when he says, come to me, he's not talking about coming for a visit, you know, tea and crumpets or something. He doesn't mean to literally meet with him. He's talking about coming to him spiritually with a desire to follow him, a desire to follow him, because a disciple means someone who studies under another person. It's like a student, you know. So we're not to study to learn profound doctrines. We are to study, not that that's wrong, but I'm saying we are to study how to be like Jesus Christ. We're to love him more than our mate. We're to love him more than our parents. We're to love him more than our children. We're to love him more than our family. We're to love him more than our own life. That's what he's saying, isn't it? He's not saying anything less than that. Well, let's get that clear. So you and I made this commitment when we were baptized. But my question is this today, has time taken its toll? Have we turned a blind eye to some things in our life? I remember a very professional lady that I talked to. It was years ago. She was quite a nice person. She emailed me saying that she had read the Sabbath test. And she said, I can't believe it. This is so clear. It's so true. It's so obvious. The next day I got an email from her with her telephone number. She says, call me immediately. And I called her and she said, I told my minister and he said, I won't put you out of the church, but I need to talk to you tomorrow. And I told her, I said, you know, he's a busy man. I said, he probably won't even come, but if he does, he's going to tell you just don't preach it. You're not going to be kicked out of the church. But I never heard from her again because she had family and she had friends in the church. So here she is saying, I know this is true. I know this is obedience to Christ, but I have family and friends over here. And so she decided family and friends counted more than Christ's truth and his Sabbath. Do you understand where I'm getting at? That's exactly what these scriptures are saying we can't do. We have to follow Christ and be his disciple. And so, anyway, and fear drove her, you know. With others, it's pleasure in life that does it, that gets us to kind of close one eye and look at things the way we want to see it, you know. In some cases, it's lust that plays its role. But look at verse 27. Do family, do friends, or the church sway us from obedience to God? And whosoever does not hear bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. So to bear our stake means this. Whatever sacrifices we have to make, we have to make them. If we don't, we're not following him. And there's going to be a curse that follows afterwards if we don't, you know. You know, it doesn't matter what we have to give up. There's a time to lose, and there's sacrifices that sometimes have to be made. Remember Paul's statement, through much affliction we enter the kingdom of God? There might be some affliction in our life, and we might experience reproach from others. We might have some afflictions that take place that we have to endure. There might be persecution, and that has happened to our people in the past, and it's possible it could happen to us in the future. But the point is it going to cause us to turn a blind eye to what Christ did for us and what he holds out as a reward for us? Because it has already happened to some people over very minor issues, you know. So whatever our human nature may pull on us to do something that we want, no matter how badly, no matter how strongly the emotion, don't give in. Don't give in. Put your foot down and do God's will, you know. We can't blind ourselves to what we're doing. We can't blind ourselves to the truth of God. If we're unwilling to follow these words, once we agree to it, are we worthy to carry his name? Are we worthy to be his disciple if we say yes and don't do? No. Our intention is to continue to adhere to our commitment. That's our intention to do this. You know, but we can't look at our lives and have a blind eye. We're set to accomplish what is the greatest achievement that man could ever have, and that is being a part of the kingdom of God. But something often causes us to turn a blind eye to certain things in our life. And so we continue here in 28. For which of you intending to build a tower sits not down first and counts the cost, whether he has sufficient to finish it? Do you remember reading this before you were baptized? Every one of us had this read to us. Lest haply after having laid the foundation is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build but wasn't able to finish. Or what king going out to make war against another king sits not down first and consults whether he's able with 10,000 to meet him that comes against him with 20,000? But you get the point. Or else while the other's yet a great way off, he sends an ambassador, and desires conditions of peace. You know, and so likewise, whoever he be of you that forsakes not all he has, he cannot be my disciple. Man, I'm asking us to really think about this, you know. You know, did we count the cost? Are we willing to pay whatever price? Because that's the commitment we made in the beginning, that we were willing to pay whatever the price was to attain the kingdom of God. But as time goes on, living life and other pressures come on us, human nature pulls on us, situations come up, circumstances come up, and sometimes we bend the rules a little bit and we kind of don't look at what we're doing over here. We don't admit it. We don't face it and so on. And so for some, it can be pride, or where others it can be pain. It doesn't matter. But I want you to think about it today, making a commitment. We will die for you like Peter, right? If necessary, we'll do whatever's necessary. But some people can't even stop going to a restaurant. I mean, we don't want to lose our comfort, and this is fun, you know? How little it might take for us to turn. It's amazing sometimes, ironic. But if you are not willing to forsake everything you have, everything, you can't be my disciple. That was our commitment. We read this before we were baptized. We made this commitment to God. And Christ is saying everything that we care about in life, there's nothing we can turn a blind eye to, nothing at all, nothing we can care about more than our calling. There is nothing we can do to get around things, to omit them. We honestly have to ask, do we want to be his disciple or not? We thought we did. We said we did. We made a commitment to do that. Let's go to Mark 4. Mark 4. We just read the requirements of being a disciple. may never come to that time where we have to give up everything and abandon all that we love here on earth. But if that's our issue, if there's something we don't want to give up, guess what? It has to come as a test, just like Abraham. Do you love your son more than me or not? You know, he had to make the choice, and he made the right one. But it took him a few years to get to that point, and it took me a few years to see this myself. You know, this is a reality that we may be faced in the future of losing it all. You game? You in? Or are you going to turn a blind eye to, well, yeah, those guys, yeah, they're Church of God, yeah, they live over here. You save your own skin. Got it? That's how it's going to happen. It's going to be push comes to shove. They're going to say, I know where they are at. I'll tell you. Just save me. That's what happens. Savior said this in Mark 4 and in verse 11. And he said unto them, unto you is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God, but unto them that are without or outside, all these things are done in parables, that seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest at any time they should be converted and their sins should be forgiven them. Now look, do you think that Christ was saying here that God has made it impossible for them to hear? You think that's what he's doing? I don't think that's what's happening, you know. He's saying, look, the parable he talked about was the seed was thrown or sown on different ground, and it produced different amounts of fruits, and in some cases it produced none. Okay? This is not hard to understand. Anybody could understand it if they were applying it to their lives. You know, I'm saying that God didn't make sure they couldn't understand it, but he talked in parables that only those people who wanted to hear could hear. You understand? Those people who were willing to apply what Christ said to their lives, they could hear and they could understand. Other people, because it's painful to think about, would turn a blind eye to what he's saying, or turn a deaf ear in this case. You know, Ezekiel 33, and this is kind of the way it happens in the Church of God down through the ages. This is what happened in Nehemiah's case when he set everything up and they signed and sealed it and they made sure we are going to do this, and they bound themselves to a curse. And then what happened? It wasn't long until they broke almost everything that they said they were going to do. And where human nature is like that, we've got to be so careful. Ezekiel 33, they hear the words. Verse 31. And they come unto you as the people come. They sit before you as my people, and they hear my words, but they will not do them. For with their mouths they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness. That's happening right now, as we speak, in this era of the Church of God. And lo, you are to them as a very lovely song of one that has a pleasant voice and can play well on the instrument. For they hear your words, but they do not do them. We all make promises that we intend to keep, and then later we find that it's going to cost us more than we thought. None of us wants to pay the higher price. But you remember the scripture, he that swears to his own hurt? That's the one who's going to walk in God's kingdom and on the streets in the kingdom. The one that keeps his word. There's a reason why this occurs, and let's go over to Matthew 15. Our heart is set on something other than God's word. And this is what kind of I see and myself, and I'm getting the picture now of what's happening to the church at this age more clearly, I think, Matthew 15 and verse 8, where it says something very similar, where he says, this people draw close to me with their mouth, and they do honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And this is the case. You know, we do what we do. We come to services. We sing our songs. We talk about God and all of that. But our heart is often split. It wants other things, too. And so we sometimes veer off course a little bit. I want you to consider for a moment the case of Cain and Abel. You know, Cain brought his offering at the right time at the end of days. There was nothing wrong with his offering. It was first fruits, and you can bring the first fruits of your vegetables. Nothing wrong with that. There was something wrong in his mind. He gave God an offering, but he held resentment towards his brother because he was the goody-goody two-shoes, much like Joseph, we'll talk about later. You know, he didn't see this as a problem for himself. He didn't see that it was a problem with God. He gives his offering, and it was not accepted because he turned a blind eye to something that was in his heart, and that was resentment and hostility towards somebody else. And so his offering was not accepted. So again, I'm saying our intentions mean very little unless we follow through. And I still remember my mom teaching me that, you know. Road to hell. You know, who would ever think, although we sometimes do, that intentions alone by themselves have some kind of value? You know, it's, I think, goes back to the old Gnostic times with, you know, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you have love in your heart. You see how close those are? If I have good intentions and I'm thinking good thoughts and about God or something, then what I do doesn't matter so much. Very close to the same thing, you know. But what would ever make us really think that by itself it has value? We've got to perform what it is that we intend. If we don't, we're fooling ourselves. We're blinding ourselves of what we're doing. You know, I see now that what we intend to do has very little value if we don't follow through. What we do is what actually matters. And sometimes we let other values creep into our minds and our hearts. And I ask you in that context, who are you really? Some people think it's their looks is who they are. That's their way they identify. Other people think it's their intellect that identifies them and makes them special and unique. Others think it's their strength is their identity. And I remember people dedicate their lives. And, when I was a kid, you know, guys like Schwarzenegger, you know, they would have all these big muscles and everything. Today you have to get ripped. You got to take diuretics. You got to do all this stuff. I mean, you have bodies that don't even look human anymore, you know. But they're all into that because that's them. That's their identity. That's what they care about. Ecclesiastes 5. But the real person that you and I are, the real individual that we are, is housed deep inside our mind. We really are the person who directs our free will. How do we direct that will that we have inside? Do we exercise our mind and our strength to do God's will? Or do we turn a blind eye towards our weaknesses? Can you see what I'm saying? I hope you can see what I'm saying because this is what human nature will do. And we all do it. We may look good. We may be smart. We may be strong. But the truth is we're made in God's image. And that means what? We're personally responsible for every action we take. That's how we're in his image. We have free will, and we are responsible for whatever we do, okay? Thinking something is fine. What we do is what really counts, you know? What we intend, what we promise, what we feel is of so little value in that context. It is what we actually do. That's who we really are. That's us. What we do defines us, not what we think. So attending services is good, and, might be that we hear something important there. We intend, make a commitment, but then we forget the commitment that we made to God. And I don't believe there isn't a one of us that hasn't forgotten the commitment we've made to God at one point in our life sometime. You know, we forget that it is directly related, though, to our relationship with Him. When we break our promise, we are breaking that tether, that connection to God. We're separating it. The more we do it, the more separate we become. And so we want to limit this. We want to stop it. Eventually, that's where we want to get to, a point where we will do whatever it takes. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 1. Keep your foot, that is, watch your step, is what he's saying, when you go to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. What is a sacrifice of fools? They consider not that they do evil. They think we're all good guys because we're in this church. We all think we're good guys because we believe this certain doctrine or have this certain calendar or pronounce God's name a certain way. You understand how crazy this is? And then he says, don't be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart be hasty to utter anything before God. In other words, oh, I'm going to be better, God. Just get me out of this mess. You know, just get me out of this mess I made, and you know, I'll do all your commandments, right? Don't be hasty to do that. Think what you're really going to do. So, God is in heaven, and you're on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by a multitude of words. When you vow a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay to him which you have vowed. Better is it than you should not vow, than you should vow and not pay. We vowed. And we were baptized. We vowed. Better we shouldn't have if we're not going to pay. So my point today is, let's pay our vows. Let's do what we say. Let's do what is right. It's so easy to avoid focusing on the consequences of our little diversions from the path that is God's. On another level, I want us to look at the case of Joseph. You know, Joseph wasn't Christ. He wasn't God in the flesh. He was a human being like you and like me. You know, he had the same hopes and dreams and so on. Genesis 37. Just an ordinary human being like all of us. And yet his example is so sterling to me as a type of Christ itself. You know, he was favored by his father, but it wasn't just that his father liked him. You know, it wasn't like he was better looking than the others or something. It was what was inside Joseph's head that made his father favor him. It's what caused his father's affection. That is this. Joseph respected his father and strove to do what was right. That's what his father could trust him. His father really appreciated that in him. And so he made him kind of special. However, the brothers became very, very hostile toward him as a result. And they finally decided, let's get rid of him. Let's get rid of him. Genesis 37 and verse 20. They said, come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit that we could say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, don't kill him. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that's in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands and deliver him to his father again. And so he's thinking, you know, this is really serious business. There are going to be consequences for this. I don't want to face. And it came to pass when Joseph was coming to his brethren, that they stripped him of his coat and of many colors that was on him, and they took him and they cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. Get this, can you imagine it? You throw your brother down into a pit, and then you go eat dinner. And there's no water in the pit. There's nothing in the pit, you know. Just, it's hard to imagine that that could be done by brothers. And yet, some of our brothers may do worse to us. And Judas said unto his brethren, what profit is it that we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother in our flesh. And his brethren were content. And so, then there passed by these Midianite merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. The brothers knew what they were doing was completely wrong. And you can imagine Joseph crying out to them from the pit, why are you doing this? We're brothers. Why, you know, I care about you, you know. Why have you done this to me? And they're listening to this, and still, what are they doing? Not hearing it. Not hearing it. They're choosing to not hear it, you know. And so anyway, they turned a blind eye to his plight and ignored their conscience. Now, I want to turn the story around and look at it, not from the brother's standpoint or what they did, but how did Joseph react? I want you to think about this. Here he is, sold into slavery in Egypt, and he becomes a slave to Potiphar. Everything now prospers under his hand. But Potiphar's wife makes wrong advances to him. He rejects the advances, and she claims rape, you know. And Potiphar comes back, and he approaches her, and he knows his wife. He knows what she's like, and he knows what Joseph's like. So he does not kill Joseph, but he puts him in jail to save himself the embarrassment of the truth going out of what really happened and what his wife did, you know. So he knew that Joseph wouldn't do any harm. Genesis 39, verse 20. Genesis 39, verse 20. So Joseph is put in jail, verse 39 and verse 20. And Joseph's master took him and put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. And the keeper of the prison looked not on anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. So, we see that Pharaoh has somebody steal something, and he doesn't know if it's the baker or the wine taster, so he puts them both in jail, and they put him in the same cell there. He's under Joseph's care, and, you know, they have this dream, and Joseph interprets the dream, and he says, you know, when you get out, you know, and it comes out to be true, you know, mention me, you know, tell him I was in this, and that I can be trusted and stuff. He's trying to get out, you know, and it turns out that the wine taster gets returned to his position, completely forgets about Joseph. Why? Because what's important to him is his life and his position and his things that he has. That's how everybody is with human nature. Forgets about Joseph. And so Joseph stays in the prison 2 more years. Okay? And does he change his commitment to God? Suffering, working as a slave, suffering in prison, you know, being told we'll help you, and then not getting the help. What does he do? Does he get angry? Does he turn against God? No. He continues to be faithful to his commitment to God. So, 2 more years, Genesis 41. Finally, Pharaoh has a dream, and now Joseph is brought up, and he's ordered out of jail to tell the Pharaoh what his dream is. And the Pharaoh sent and called, in verse 14, Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved himself, changed his raiment, came into Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I've dreamed a dream. There's none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of you that you can't understand dreams and interpret it. And so God gives Joseph the answer to the dream. And there's going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And so Pharaoh honors him in verse 38. Verse 38, and Pharaoh said unto his servants, can we find such a one as this, and a man in whom the Spirit of God is? And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, for as much as God has showed you all this, there's none so discreet and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I've set you over all the land of Egypt. And the Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures and linen, and put fine gold chain upon his neck. And so you get the picture here. This is all a type of Christ going through the suffering and being loved by the Father and being put in jail and abused, but finally becoming the one who's the ruler under the Father. He's the next one in line under the Father, and he rules there and all over Egypt. And so his famine that he had prophesied comes, and his brothers visit Egypt to try to get some food. And finally, they were able to reconcile with Joseph. And what I want us to do today is I want us just to think of the difference, to look at these different men and their actions. And Joseph suffered for years. He was 30 years old when this took place. So he was approximately, I think, around 16 when they threw him in the pit. So we're talking about 30 years here, at least 15, 16, yeah, 14 years. 14 years he's suffering all the time as a slave and as a prisoner in jail. He's suffering all that time, never flinches. He hurt, he cried, he prayed, he begged, he did all that stuff. He didn't want to be there, but that wasn't going to change his obedience to God. It wouldn't do it. He would not turn or turn a blind eye so that he could have something pleasant or pleasurable or something while he was in this. He did not do it. Never turned a blind eye to God and his commitment to God. Never, ever did any harm to Potiphar, to his wife, to the Pharaoh, to his brothers. He didn't hate them. He didn't do anything at all. He was so like Christ, and he wasn't Christ. That's my point. He was me and you. It's the decision you make in your mind, the commitment, and what you do. And that's what he did, and he's the example for us. A very real example of a human being. Over and over, the scriptures state this important truth. You won't know a true Christian by what that professing Christian says, Matthew 7. You're not going to know them by what they feel. You're going to know them by what? By their fruits, by what they do. Matthew 7, verse 16. You shall know them by their fruits, he says. Do men gather grapes or thorns or figs of thistles? No. Even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. Neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Now, can you understand that this is saying the same thing as everyone that says and doesn't do is cast into the fire? Do you get this? That's what he's saying here. It's the same thing with different words. Therefore, by their fruits you shall know them. Not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father which is in heaven, which is the commitment you and I made when we were baptized. And yes, every one of us have diverted from that path at times. But now, of all the times when we see the world closing in around us, when we see the prophecies taking place in the demise of America, and we see that Europe is going to have to rise to put an end to the Muslim threat, we see all this happening right before our very eyes. Now's not the time to let down. Now's not the time to divert. Now's the time to do what a Christian's supposed to do and what we promised to do. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, and in your name cast out devils, and in your name done many wonderful works? Then I'll profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. And so here are people that are duplicitous. They're professing God. They're doing things that are religious. And yet they have something else going on inside their little heart. And they're pursuing other pursuits. And in some cases, even using Christ in his name for their own profit and benefit. Yes, it happens. James says this so clearly. Faith without works is dead. Are you hearing that in this context of the sermon? Faith without works is dead. It's useless. It's of no value whatsoever. Man, that's heavy. So, in another place, he says, if you know to do good, but you don't do it, it's sin. That's James. Matthew 7. Therefore, verse 24, whosoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man that built his house upon a rock, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and they beat upon the house, and it fell not, for it was founded on a rock. And everyone that hears these sayings of mine and does them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and they beat upon the house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. And all these winds blowing, and all the rain coming, and all of that are talking about the storms in life, the difficult times, the harsh times when pressures come on us. That's what it's talking about. That house falls. Because the people who built it didn't build it on the rock. Christ is the rock. You know, remember that. So anyway, Revelation 3, and we'll end here. Human beings are the masters of rationalization. Masters of rationalization. We know that we're supposed to examine ourselves more than once a year at Passover, it says in 2 Corinthians, and we've read it before. We're to examine ourselves every day, and we're to examine ourselves to see if we're doing what we intend to do and what we promised to do. That's what we should be doing, examining ourselves every day. And so if we see something that's askew, a little off the path, we can correct it. And that's the point. Each day is a new day. We wake up like from the grave. You understand it's a type. The nighttime is a type of sleep and living in a dark world. Then the sun comes and Christ returns and we get up. It's all symbolic. But my point is it's a new day and you get a new start. Everybody gets a fresh start every day. And that we can correct those things we failed at yesterday. And so we can do this, examine ourselves, and make sure we keep on that path and don't veer off of it, or we can turn a blind eye if we want to. And today I'm imploring us, is what I'm doing. You know, don't turn a blind eye to the commitment we made to our Creator. Focus on our inner sin and strive to overcome it seriously. Revelation 3, I want you to understand something that I think I see more clearly today, what this is saying. Because you say, I'm rich and I'm increased with goods in verse 17, and I have need of nothing. And Christ is saying, you don't see yourself the way you really are. You're turning a blind eye to how you really are, is what he's saying. Don't you know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked? You got it? They are thinking they're fine, but they're turning a blind eye to what they really are. This we must not do, especially now at this time. And so he counsels them to buy gold, that is character, tried in the fire, the tribulation, that you may be rich, and white raiment, that you may be clothed, and that the shame of your nakedness does not appear, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see. See what? See what you're doing. See who you really are. That it's what we do, not what we wish, think, feel, promise, want, intend. It's what we do. Will we see it? So I'm asking us today, let's anoint our eyes with the Spirit of God and look at those things in our life that we need to change to get ready for what is soon to come. And let's make a choice, a mental choice, to not turn a blind eye to our real condition.